fine structures are rendered in pin-sharp detail, like an illustration in a textbook. The fact that the brain tissue was so badly damaged before she was able to take her sample mainly shows itself by the presence, as she shifts the slide minutely under the turret, of foreign matter, dust motes, human hair, and bacterial cells, as well as the expected fungal mycelia among the neurons. The nerve cells themselves are completely and thrillingly laid out to her gaze. She sees what other commentators have seen, but what she has never been able to verify with the inadequate and jury-rigged equipment available to her at the base. She sees exactly how the cuckoo Ophiocordyceps builds its nest in the thickets of the brain, how its mycelia wrap themselves, thread thin, around neuronal dendrites, like ivy around an oak. Except that ivy doesn't whisper siren songs to the oak and steal it from itself. Cuckoos? Ivy? Sirens? Focus, Caroline, she tells herself fiercely. Look at what's in front of you and draw appropriate inferences where the evidence exists to support them. The evidence exists. Now she sees what other eyes have missed. The cracks in the fortress. Focus. The places where the massively parallel structures of the human brain have regrouped, forlorn and outnumbered, around and between the fungus-choked nerve cells. Some uninfected clusters of neurons have actually grown denser, although the newer cells are bloated and threadbare, ruptured from within by jagged sheets of amyloid plaque. Caldwell's scalp prickles as she realizes the significance of what she's seeing. It would have happened quite slowly, she reminds herself. The earlier researchers didn't chart this progression because, immediately post-breakdown, it hadn't yet reached a point where it could be visually verified. The only way anyone could have found it would have been by guessing it might be there and testing for it. Caldwell lifts her head and steps back from the imaging rig. It's hard but necessary. She could stare into that green world for hours, for whole days, and keep on finding new wonders there. Later, perhaps. But later is starting to be a word that has no referent for her. Later is another day or two of rising fever and loss of function, followed by a painful, undignified death. She has the first half of a working hypothesis. Now she has to finish this project while she still can. In Caldwell's lab back at the base, there are, or were, dozens of slides taken from the brain tissue of test subject 16, Marcia, and test subject 22, Liam. If these were still available to her now, she'd use them. She's not profligate with resources, despite the comment she once made in desperation to Justineau about amassing as many observations as she could in the hope that some pattern might finally emerge. Now she has her pattern, has, at least, a hypothesis that can be tested. But all her existing samples from the test subjects at the base, the children who seem to have a partial immunity to the effects of Ophiocordyceps, have been taken from her. She needs new samples. From test subject number one. But she knows that Helen Justineau will resist any attempt she makes to dissect Melanie, or even take a biopsy from her brain. And both Sergeant Parks and Private Gallagher have, as Caldwell feared from the start, developed unacceptably close relationships with the test subject through repeated interaction in a partially normalized social context. There's no guarantee now that if she announced an intention to obtain brain tissue samples from Melanie, she would be supported by anyone in the group. So she makes her plans on the assumption that she has already issued that announcement and been refused. She unfolds and assembles the collapsible airlock around the midsection door. Its ingenious, multi-hinged construction makes this relatively straightforward, despite the clumsiness of her hands. It's not just the bandages now. The earlier tenderness of the inflamed tissue has given way to a general loss of sensation and response. She tells her fingers to do something, and they react late, move fitfully, like a car starting in winter. But she perseveres. Fully extended, the airlock bolts into 8 grooved channels, 4 in the ceiling of the vehicle and 4 in its floor. Each bolt needs to be shot home and then anchored with a sleeve bracket that tightens by the turning of a wheel. Caldwell has to use both hands and a wrench, 8 times. Long before she's finished, feeling has returned to her hands in the form of intense and unremitting pain. The agony makes her whimper aloud in spite of herself. The sides and front of the airlock are made of an ultra-flexible but extremely strong plastic. Its top and bottom now need to be sealed with a quick-hardening solution, shot from a handheld applicator. Caldwell has to hold it in the crook of her left elbow, using the thumb of her right hand to depress the trigger. The result is a mess, but she verifies that the seal is perfect by pumping the air out of the airlock and watching the pressure gauge drop smoothly to 0. Very good. She pumps fresh air in, bringing the airlock to normal pressure. She takes manual control of the doors and routes it to her own computer in the lab. She leaves both doors closed, but only the inner door locked. Then she manhandles a cylinder of compressed phosgene gas into the airlock's reserve chamber. She has already noted the cylinder's presence during her initial search of the lab's contents and assumed that it was there to assist in the synthesis of organic polymers. But it has other uses, of course, including the rapid and effective suffocation of large lab animals without widespread tissue damage. Now she waits. And while she waits, she examines her own feelings about what she's about to do. She's reluctant to dwell on the effects of the gas on her human companions. Phosgene is more humane than its close relative, chlorine, but that's not saying very much. Caldwell is hoping that Melanie will enter the airlock first and that it will be possible to lock the outer door before anyone else follows her in. She's aware, though, that this is unlikely. It's far more probable that Helen Justanu will enter either alongside Melanie or else precede her into the vehicle. This prospect doesn't trouble Caldwell too much. There's even a certain rightness to it. Justanu's many interventions have contributed very substantially to the present absurd situation in which Caldwell has to plot to recover control of her own specimen. But she hopes, at least, that it won't be necessary to kill Parks or Gallagher. The two soldiers will probably bring up the rear, covering Justanu and Melanie until they're inside Rosie, by which time the door can be locked against them. None of this is perfect. It's not as though she wants to commit what more or less amounts to murder. But her hypothesis is so huge in its implications that to shrink from murder would be a crime against humanity. She has a duty, and she has an interval of time in which she can still work. That interval is most likely measurable not in days, but in hours. Caldwell has pulled back the baffles from the window in the lab so that she can peer out into the street and see the rescue party when it returns. But the pain in her hands and arms has exhausted her. Despite her best efforts, she dozes. She drifts in and out of consciousness. Every time she forces her eyelids open, they lower themselves again by subliminal increments. After one of these times, Caldwell finds herself meeting, at a distance, through the window, the gaze of a small child, who is standing in a doorway almost directly opposite her. A hungry, obviously. Age at the time of primary infection, no more than 5. Naked, scrawny, and indescribably filthy, like a disaster victim in a charity appeal broadcast before the breakdown, in those innocent days when a few thousand dead felt like a disaster. The little boy is watching Caldwell avidly and unblinkingly, and he's not alone. It's late afternoon now, and the long shadows provide a lot of natural cover. But like the details in a puzzle picture, the other hungries emerge from the background one by one. An older, red-haired girl behind the rusting hulk of a parked car. A black-haired boy, older still, crouched in the remains of a shop window display, with an aluminium baseball bat clutched in his hands. Two more behind him, in the shop itself, on hands and knees underneath a rack of sun-bleached and mouldering dresses. A whole pack of them. Caldwell is enthralled. She'd always known, when Parks and his people said the supply of test subjects in the wild had dried up, that it could mean many things. One possibility, at the time she thought it implausible, but she's not so certain now, was that the feral infected children had been intelligent enough to perceive the sergeant and his trappers as a threat and to move on to new hunting grounds. Now Caldwell watches as the black-haired boy signals to the two behind him with a toss of the head, and they come up level with him to see what he's seeing. He's the leader, obviously. He's also one of the very few who are not completely naked. He wears a camouflage jacket on his narrow, bony shoulders. At some point, he's brought down a soldier and taken a fancy to his hide as well as his flesh. His face is a riot of smudged colour, a tribal display of status and potency. Caldwell sees how the hungry children operate as a pack, how they signal using silent gestures and facial expressions, how they coordinate their efforts against this unfamiliar thing in their midst. Perhaps it's the sound that has brought them, the steady hum of the generator. Or perhaps they've been watching Rosie for a while now, having followed Justinu or Gallagher back here after one of their excursions. But whatever it was that attracted their attention, now they've seen her. And having seen her, they're stalking her. Even though she's immured behind unbreakable glass in an oversized battle tank whose armaments could blast the buildings all around into rubble and powder, even though there's no obvious way to reach her and no way of quantifying the risk she poses, even though, crucially, they can't smell her through steel and glass and polymer and airtight seals. They recognise her as prey, and they're responding accordingly. Caldwell is not immediately conscious of having made the decision as she rises to her feet and walks softly out of the lab towards the midsection door. But it's a good decision. She can justify it on any number of grounds. She returns the door control functions to the panel beside the airlock itself. Then she slides the outer door open and closed again, several times over, testing its operation at various speed settings. She watches the hydraulic valves, as thick as her forearms, sliding smoothly backwards and forwards at the top and bottom of the door. Even at the third speed setting, there are seven that are faster. She estimates that the valves are exerting in excess of 500 foot-pounds of pressure. The inner door, by contrast, is operated by simpler mechanical servos. It was never anticipated that the airlock would have to function as a second restraint cage. Caldwell takes into account a number of highly pertinent factors. There's no telling whether Test Subject 1 will even return from the expedition. If she does, it's far from certain that the ambush Caldwell has already mounted will work. Or if it works, how any survivors would respond to the deaths of those caught in the airlock. But the truth, or at least part of it, is that she can't resist. These monsters are hunting her. She wants to hunt them in return, and to enfold their efforts effortlessly in her wider stratagem. With the outer door opened fully, she slides the inner airlock door open halfway. She stands up against the opening and waits. Her body is still sticky with sweat from her earlier exertions. Her pheromones, she knows, are now spreading outward from her body on the turbulent gradients of the cooling afternoon air. With every breath, the hungry children are inhaling her. Sentient they may be, and cooperative, and sly. But their nature being what it is, it's only a matter of time before they respond. It's the red-haired girl who moves first. She comes out from behind the car, walks straight into the open and advances towards Rosie's inviting doorway. The boy in the camouflage jacket makes a sound like a bark. The red-haired girl slows, reluctantly, and turns to face him. The younger boy from the shop doorway shoots past her at a dead run and flings himself directly at the door. It's so sudden and so fast that Caldwell, even though this is exactly what she's been waiting for, barely has time to react. Her thumb closes on a switch. The hungry boy leaps the sill of the outer door and throws himself at Caldwell like a missile, arms outstretched to catch and clutch. But before he can reach her, the inner door slams shut. Caldwell has underestimated the power of the servos. The door closes on the hungry's upper body like a nutcracker, crushing its ribs. The hungry opens its mouth to scream, but its lungs are terminally and irreversibly deflated. Screaming is no longer an option. It's been trapped with one arm behind its torso, inside the airlock, the other thrust forward. It's still straining futilely to reach Caldwell, its slender fingers stretched out. One of them actually flicks the sleeve of her lab coat, but the infection can't be contracted from a scratch, only from blood or saliva. With her goggles and face mask in place, she's not at risk. The creature's head, Caldwell notes, is completely undamaged. She feels a dizzying surge of elation, and she laughs aloud. She half laughs. The rest of the sound is choked off as something streaks in from the street and smacks into her jaw, ripping right through the wire and paper of the face mask. The agony is astonishing. Caldwell's mouth fills up with blood in which broken-off pieces of tooth grate against each other with a dull, shipwrecked sound. The stone clatters along the floor, dark red with her spilled blood. The red-haired girl is already loading another into the strip of faded cloth or leather she's using as a sling. The boy's crushed body is wedging the door open about 3 inches. The outer door is still gaping wide, and the hungry's outside. Its cohort, its friends, are racing into the breach with their makeshift weapons raised. Caldwell's hand lashes out by pure reflex, hitting the controls for the outer door. It starts to close, but she's forgotten to raise the speed from level 3 to level 10. At the last moment, the tip of the baseball bat is thrust into the narrowing gap, where it wedges tight. The hydraulics whine, and the edge of the door bites deep into the metal of the bat, starts to slice it in two. But now little hands come groping around the edges of the door, some of them reaching for Caldwell, most of them wrestling with the door to keep it from closing. But they can't get to her. But they're pulling at the door determinedly, shifting their position to allow more hands to get a grip, to add their efforts. Caldwell knows how strong that door is, so when she sees it start to open again, the sudden shock makes her body rebel against her will. She staggers back, fists coming up to her mouth as though she could hide behind them. The painted face of the black-haired boy appears in the gap of the outer door. He fixes her with baleful, bloodshot eyes, telling her in wordless grimaces that this is personal now. Which means he thinks of himself as a person. Amazing. Caldwell sprints for the cockpit, where she slams down 2 more levers, engaging wheels and weapons. She can't operate both at once, of course. She'll be lucky if she can remember how to drive this thing, on a few days' training received 2 decades ago. For a terrifying moment, the entire console seems suddenly alien and meaningless. She has to drag her brain out of the adrenaline flood and back under her conscious control. The button marked E. That comes first, and it's right there, in the centre of the steering column. It stands for elevate. Rosie's chassis lifts itself 8 inches higher off the road, hissing like a snake as the hydraulics kick in. Caldwell sees some of the hungries scatter, but the booming and banging from the midsection tell her that some of them are still at work there. Panic twists her innards. She has to get out of here. She knows she might be bringing the enemy with her, but if she stays, she's dog meat. They'll get the outer door open eventually, and then the inner door will hold them for a few seconds at most. Caldwell takes the steering column in her unresponsive hands, pushes hard forward, and prays. The brakes disengage without being asked to. Rosie shakes herself like a dog and lurches into motion, so fast and so sudden that Caldwell is thrown backwards into the driving seat. Her hands slip partway off the grips, and the behemoth slews across the road, punching into a lamppost and ripping it right out of the ground with a clang like the bell that signals the start of a boxing match. Caldwell has to grip more tightly and pull hard to bring Rosie straight again. The pain makes her scream aloud, but she can barely hear the sound over the full-throated roar of the engines. She has no idea what's happening at the midsection door, because the engine noise hides those sounds too. So she pushes harder, takes the column all the way to the top of its grooved channel. The street becomes a grey blur. There's another impact, then a third, but Caldwell is aware of them only as vibrations. Rosie has so much momentum now that she parts the world like water. Figures in the street, briefly in front of her, then beside her, then gone. More Hungries? One of them looked like Parks, but there's no way of finding out without stopping, and she doesn't want to do that. In fact, for the moment, she doesn't even remember how. Some parts of the console, though, are starting to look a lot more familiar now. Caldwell realises that she doesn't have to be blind. Rosie has cameras mounted along her entire length, most of which can be swivelled to look in any direction. She flicks them all on and scans the left-hand feeds. One of them is dead-centred on the midsection door, where two Hungries have managed to keep their grip on the moving juggernaut. One is the leader, his jacket whipping in Rosie's slipstream like a flag. The other is the red-haired girl. Caldwell swerves right, up a steep incline where a road sign points towards Highgate and Kentish Town. She leaves the turn to the last moment, then yanks the steering column as hard as she can so that Rosie lists sharply. But the incline slows her, and the effect isn't as spectacular as she was hoping. The Hungries are still hanging on, still wrestling with the partly opened door. Caldwell has been here before, a long time ago, pre-breakdown. Memories stir, filling her mind with surreal juxtapositions. Houses she once aspired to live in flick past her, squat and dark like widows in a Spanish cemetery, waiting patiently for the resurrection. At the top of the hill she turns again. She misjudges the angle, punches out part of the wall of a pub that stands on the corner. Rosie isn't perturbed, though the rear-view cameras show the buildings slumping into ruin behind her. There's a narrow elbow of road, then a long, wide sweep down towards central London. Caldwell piles on the acceleration again and leans hard over, deliberately scraping Rosie's left flank against the long exterior wall of what looks like a school building. The sign above the gate reads La Santa Union. Pulverised brick powders the windscreen, and there's a shriek of tortured metal even louder than the engine roar. Rosie endures, and Caldwell is rewarded by the sight of at least one of the Hungries flung loose in the hard rain. She yells at the top of her voice, a banshee shriek of triumph and defiance. Blood from her wounded mouth flecks the windscreen in front of her. She veers back out into the centre of the road, glancing at the cameras again. No sign of the Hungries now. She has to stop so that she can examine her prize and make sure it's still intact. But the Hungries she's just shaken off might still be alive. She remembers the look on the painted face of the black-haired boy. He'll follow her for as long as his legs still work. So she drives on, more or less due south, through Camden Town. Euston lies beyond, and after that she'll be approaching the river. The streets remain empty, but Caldwell is wary. 11 million people used to live in this city. Behind these blind windows and closed doors, some of them must still be waiting, stuck halfway between life and death. She's figured out the brakes by this time and she slows, intimidated by the echoing bellow of Rosie's engines in these desolate landscapes. She feels for a sickening moment that she might be the last human being left alive on the face of a necrotic planet, and that it might not matter after all. To have the race that built these mausoleums lie in them finally, quiet and resigned, and crumble into dust. who'd miss us. It's the come down after the adrenaline high of taking her specimen and shaking off her enemies. That and the fever. Caldwell shudders and her vision swims. The road ahead of her seems to dissolve all at once into a grey smear. The dysfunction is sudden and spectacular. Is she going blind? That can't happen. Not yet. She needs another day, a few hours at least. She brings Rosie to a jerking, screaming stop, locks the column, and runs a hand over her face, massaging her eyes with thumb and forefinger to clear them. They feel like hot marbles nestling in her skull. But when she ventures to open them and look out through the cockpit's windshield, there's nothing wrong with how they work. There really is a great wall, 40 feet high, that's been thrown across the road ahead of her. And finally, after a minute or more of baffled awe, she knows it for what it is. It's her nemesis, her mighty opposite. It's Ophiocordyceps. Chapter 63. Miss Justineau is furious, so Melanie does her best to be furious too. But it's hard, for lots of reasons. She's still sad about Kieran being killed, and the being sad seems to stop the being angry from getting started. And Dr. Caldwell driving away in the big truck means that Melanie won't have to see either one of them again, which makes her want to jump up and down and punch the air with her hands. So while Sergeant Parks is using all the bad words he knows, it seems like, and Miss Justineau is sitting by the side of the road with a sad, dazed face, Melanie is thinking, "Goodbye, Dr. Caldwell. Drive far, far away, and don't come back." Then Miss Justineau says, "That's it. We're dead." And that changes everything. Melanie thinks about what's going to happen now, instead of just about how she feels, and her stomach goes all cold suddenly. Because Miss Justineau is right. They've used up the last of the E-blocker. The food smell is really strong on them, and Melanie is amazed that she's able to be this close without wanting to bite them. She's become used to it somehow. It's like the part of her that just wants to eat and eat and eat is locked up in a little box, and she doesn't have to open the box if she doesn't want to. But that's not going to help Miss Justineau and Sergeant Parks very much. They've got to keep walking through this city, smelling like food, and they won't walk far before they meet something that wants to eat them. "We have to follow her," Melanie says, full of urgency now that she sees what's at stake. "We have to get back inside." Sergeant Parks gives her a searching look. "Can you do it?" he asks her. "The way you did with Gallagher. Is there a trail?" Melanie hasn't even thought of it until then, but now she breathes in deep and finds it at once. There's a trail so strong it's like a river running through the air. It's got a bit of Dr. Caldwell in it, and a bit of something else that might be a hungry, or more than one hungry. But mostly it's the stinky chemical smell of Rosie's engine. She could follow it blindfolded. She could follow it in her sleep. Parks sees it in her face. "Okay," he says. "Let's get going." Justineau stares at him wild-eyed. "She was pushing 60 miles an hour," she says, her mouth twisted in a snarl. "She's gone. There's no way in God's green earth we're going to catch up with her." "We won't know unless we try," Parks counters. "Want to lie down and die, Helen, or give it a shot?" "It's going to come to the same thing either way." "Then die on your feet."
"Please, Miss Justineau," Melanie begs. "Let's go a little way at least. We can stop when it gets dark and find somewhere to hide."
What she's thinking is, they have to get out of these streets, where the hungry children who are just like her live and hunt. She thinks she might be able to protect Miss J against ordinary hungries, but not against the painted face boy and his fierce tribe. Sergeant Parks holds out a hand. Miss Justineau just stares at it, but he keeps it there in front of her, and in the end she takes it. She lets him haul her to her feet. "How many hours of daylight have we got left?" she asks.
"Maybe two."
"We can't move in the dark, Parks. And Caroline can. She's got headlights."
Parks concedes the point with a curt nod. We follow until it's too dark to see. Then we hole up. In the morning, if there's still a strong trail, we carry on. If not, we look for some tar or creosote or some other shit like that to mask our scent, the way the junkers do. And we keep on heading south. He turns to Melanie.
"Go ahead, lassie," he says. "Do your stuff."
Melanie hesitates.
"I think," she says.
"Yeah? What is it?"
"I think maybe I'll be able to run a lot faster than the two of you, Sergeant Parks."
Parks laughs, a short, harsh sound.
"Yeah, I think so too," he says. "We'll do the best we can. Keep us in sight, that's all."
Then he has a better idea and turns to Justinu.
"Let her have the walkie-talkie," he tells her. "If we lose her, she can call us and talk us in."
Justinu hands the rig to Melanie, and Sergeant Parks shows her how to send and receive with it. It's simple enough, but designed for much bigger fingers than hers. She practices until she gets it right. Then Parks shows her how to hook it onto the waistband of her pink unicorn jeans, where it looks ridiculously large and cumbersome. Miss Justinu gives her a smile of encouragement. Underneath it, Melanie can see all her fears, her grief and exhaustion. How close she is to empty. She goes up to Miss J and gives her a short, intense hug.
"It'll be all right," she says. "I won't let anything hurt you."
It's the first time they've hugged like this, with Melanie giving comfort rather than receiving it. And she remembers Miss Justinu making the same promise to her, although she couldn't say exactly when. She feels a pang of nostalgia for that time, whenever it was. But she knows that you can't be a child forever, even if you want to be. She sets off at a run and slowly accelerates. But she holds herself to a speed that the two grown-ups can just about keep up with. At each junction she waits until they jog into sight before setting off again. Walkie-talkie or not, she's not going to leave them to their own devices with the night coming on. A night that she knows contains so many terrible things. Chapter 64. Caroline Caldwell gets out of Rosie using the cockpit door rather than the midsection door. The midsection door still has the airlock attached and her hungry specimen jammed into it. She walks 20 paces forward. That's as far as she can go, more or less. She stares at the grey wall for a long time, for whole minutes probably, although she doesn't really trust her time sense anymore. Her wounded mouth throbs in time with her heartbeat, but her nervous system is like a flooded carburettor. The engine doesn't catch. The confused signals don't coalesce into pain. Caldwell registers the wall's construction, its height and width and depth. The depth is just an estimate, and the time it must have taken to form. She knows exactly what she's looking at, but knowing doesn't help. She's going to die soon, and she'll die with this thing in front of her. This gauntlet, flung down by a bullying, contemptuous universe that allowed human beings to grope their way to sentience just so it could put them in their place that bit more painfully. Caldwell makes herself move, eventually. She does the only thing she can think of to do. She picks up the gauntlet. Returning to Rosie, she lets herself back in through the cockpit door, which she closes and locks. She goes through the crew quarters and the lab to the midsection. She stops briefly in the lab to replace her face mask, which was ripped when the slingshot stones smacked into it. She scrubs up and dons surgical gloves, takes a bone saw from a rack and a plastic tray from a shelf. A bucket would be better, but she has no bucket. The hungry she caught is still moving sluggishly, despite the horrific damage the door mechanism has done to the muscles and tendons of its upper body. Seen from this close,
The size of the head in relation to the body suggests that it may have been even younger at the time of initial infection than Caldwell had previously estimated. But then she's about to test that hypothesis, isn't she? The Hungry's right arm is jammed behind it, inside the airlock space. Caldwell secures the left arm by catching it in the noose of a plasticated twine and tying the free end of the twine to a bracket on the wall. She wraps the twine around her own forearm 3 or 4 times and uses her body weight to pull it tight against the Hungry's struggles. The loops of twine bite deep into her arm, where the flesh has gone from angry red to sullen purple. She feels very little pain, which is a bad sign in itself. Nerve damage in necrotized flesh is irreversible and progressive. As quickly as she can, but carefully, she saws off the Hungry's head. It grunts and snaps its jaws at her throughout the whole of this process. Both of its arms flail violently, the left one within a tight circular arc defined by the free play of the twine. Neither arm can reach her. The fragile upper vertebrae yield to the saw almost instantly. It's the muscle, on which the blade alternately sticks and slides, that's hardest. When Caldwell is through the vertebrae, the Hungry's head sags suddenly, opening the incision wide to show the severed nubs of bone, shockingly white. By contrast, the liquor that drips down from the wound onto the tray and the floor all around is mostly grey, shot with rivulets of red. The last thin ribbon of flesh tears under the head's own weight, and the head abruptly falls. It hits the edge of the tray, flipping it over, and rolls away across the floor. The Hungry's body is still moving very much as it did when the head was still attached. Its arms windmill uselessly, its legs step slide on the airlock's grooved metal floor. Colonies of cordyceps anchored to the spine are still trying to commandeer the dead child and make it work for the greater good of its fungal passenger. The movements slow, while Caldwell bends to retrieve the head, but they haven't entirely stopped when she straightens again and takes the head through into the lab. Safety first. She leaves the head on the work surface for a moment or two while she returns to clear the airlock, flinging the still twitching headless corpse out into the road. It lies there like a reproach, not just to Caldwell, but to scientific endeavour in general. Caldwell turns her back on it and slams the door. If the road to knowledge was paved with dead children, which at some times and in some places it has been, she'd still walk it and absolve herself afterwards. What other choice would she have? Everything she values is at the end of that road. She closes the doors, returns to the lab, and sets to work. Chapter 65. Melanie is waiting when Justinu and Parks finally turn into the long road that has Euston Station at the other end of it. Wordlessly she points, and Justinu looks, breathless, lathered in sweat, her legs and chest knotting in agony. It's all she can do. Halfway along the broad avenue, Rosie has slewed to a halt on a steep diagonal, practically touching the curb on both sides. Directly in front of the vehicle, a huge barricade blocks the street. It rises to a height of 40 feet or so, which puts it higher than the houses on either side. In the low, slanting sunlight, Justinu can see that it continues over the houses, into them, and beyond them. It looks like a sheer vertical at first, but then its subtle tones resolve themselves, and she can see that it's a slope like the side of a mountain. It's as though a million tons of dirty snow has fallen in this one spot. Parks joins her and they continue to boggle in unison. "Any idea?" the sergeant asks at last. Justinu shakes her head. "You?" "I prefer to look at all the evidence first. Then I get someone smarter than I am to explain it to me." They go forward slowly, alert for any hostile movement. Rosie has been in the wars, and they can see the aftermath, the dents and scrapes on the armour plating, the blood and tissue plastered around the midsection door, the small, crumpled body lying in the street, right beside the vehicle. The body is a hungry, a child, male, no older than 4 or 5. His head is gone, no sign of it anywhere nearby, and his upper body is crushed almost flat, as though someone put his narrow chest in a vice and tightened it. Melanie kneels to examine him more closely, her expression solemn and thoughtful. Justinu stands over her, searching for words and not finding any. She can see that the boy wears a bracelet of hair, perhaps his own, on his right wrist. As a badge of identity, it couldn't be clearer. He was like Melanie, not like the regular Hungries. "I'm sorry," Justinu says. Melanie says nothing. A movement in Justinu's peripheral vision makes her turn her head. Sergeant Parks is looking the same way, towards Rosie's central section. Caroline Caldwell has stripped the duct tape away from the lab window and slid back the light baffles. She's staring out at them, her expression hard and impassive. Justinu goes over to the window and mouths, "What are you doing?" Caldwell shrugs. She makes no move to let them in. Justinu hammers on the window, gestures to the midsection door. Caldwell goes away for a few moments, then comes back with an A5 notepad. She holds it up to show Justinu what she's written on the top sheet. "I have to work. Very close to a breakthrough. I think you might try to stop me. Sorry." Justinu throws out her arms, indicating the empty street, the long shadows of late afternoon. She doesn't have to say or mime anything. The message is clear. "We're going to die." Caldwell watches her for a moment longer, then once again closes the baffles right across the window. Parks is on his knees now, a few feet to Justinu's left. He's working the crank to open the door, but it's not opening, even though he's encouraging it with a continuous stream of bad language. Caldwell must have disabled the emergency access. Melanie is still kneeling beside the beheaded body, either grieving or else so lost in thought that she's not aware right now of what's going on around her. Justinu's stomach is churning and she feels sick. From the hard running, and now from this lethal smack in the face. She walks on a little, trying to outdistance the nausea, until she comes to the outermost reaches of the wall. It's not a wall at all, but an avalanche, a formless sprawl of matter in slow-motion advance. It's made from the tendrils of Ophiocordyceps, from billions of fungal mycelia interwoven more finely than any tapestry. The threads are so delicate that they're translucent, allowing Justinu to peer into the mass to a depth of 10 feet or so. Everything within it is cocooned, colonized, wrapped in hundreds of thicknesses of the stuff. Outlines are softened, colours muted to 1,000 shades of grey. Justinu's dizziness and nausea return. She sits, slowly, rests her head in her hands until the feelings stop. She's aware of Melanie walking past her, skirting the edge of the thing and then seemingly about to walk into it. "Don't!" Justinu yells. Melanie looks at her in surprise. "But it's only like cotton, Miss Justinu. Or like a cloud that's come down to the ground. It can't hurt us." She demonstrates, bending to run a hand lightly through the fluffy mass. It parts cleanly, retains a perfect image of the hand's passage. The threads she's touched cling to her skin like spiderwebs. Justinu scrambles up to pull her away, gently but firmly. "I don't know," she says. "Maybe it can, maybe it can't. I don't want to find out." She asks Melanie to brush the stuff off her hands, very carefully, onto a tuft of grass that's sprouting up from the ruined pavement nearby. The fungal threads are wrapped around the grass stalks too, and most of it appears to be dead, much more grey than green showing. They go back to Parks, who's given up trying to open the midsection door and is now sitting with his back to Rosie, leaning against one of her rear treads. He's holding his canteen, weighing it carefully in his hands. He takes a swig as they approach, then hands it to Justinu to do likewise. When she takes it, she realizes from its weight that it must be almost empty. She gives it back. "I'm good," she lies.
"Bullshit," Park says. "Drink and be merry, Helen. I'm going to go look around these houses shortly. See if there's anything left standing in rain buckets or gutters. God will provide."
"You think?"
"He's known for it."
She drains the canteen and slumps down beside him, dropping it into his lap. She looks up at the sky, which is darkening. Sunset's maybe half an hour away, so Parks is probably bluffing about looking for standing water, which anyway would likely be full of all kinds of bad shit. Melanie sits cross-legged between them and facing them. "What now?" Justinu asks. Parks makes a non-committal gesture.
"I guess we wait a while longer and then we pick one of these houses. Secure it as far as we can before it gets dark. Try and fix up some kind of a barricade, because we've got to be leaving a scent trail now as well as a heat trail. Hungries will find us long before morning."
Justinu is torn between despair and choking rage. She goes with the rage because she's afraid the despair will paralyze her. "If I get my hands on that bitch," she mutters, "I'll beat her brains out and then mount the best parts on microscope slides." Moved by some atavistic reflex, she adds, "Sorry, Melanie." "It's all right," Melanie says. "I don't like Dr. Caldwell either." When the sun touches the horizon, they finally force themselves to move. The lights are on in the lab by this time, a little of their glow spilling around the edges of the baffles so that the windows look as though they've been drawn on Rosie's side in luminous paint. The rest of the world is dark, and getting darker. Parks turns to Melanie very abruptly, as though he's nerving himself up to something. "You sleepy, kid?" he asks her. Melanie shakes her head for no.
"You scared?"
She has to think about this one, but it's no again. "Not for me," she qualifies. "The Hungries won't hurt me. I'm scared for Miss Justinu."
"Then maybe you could run an errand for me."
Parks points at the lowering grey mass.
"I don't fancy our chances going through that stuff. I don't know whether it could infect us or not, but I'm pretty sure it could choke us to death if we breathed enough of it in."
"So?" Melanie demands.
"So, I'd like to know if there's a way around it. Maybe you could go check it out. Once we've found a bolt hole for ourselves. Might make a difference tomorrow if we know where we're going."
"I can do that," Melanie says. Justinu is unhappy at the thought, but she knows it makes sense. Melanie can survive out here in the dark. She and Parks definitely can't.
"Are you sure?" she asks. Melanie is very sure.
Chapter 66. She's even keen to do it, because she's restless and unhappy about everything that's happened today. Kieran dying because her story, her lie, frightened him away. And then Dr. Caldwell driving off and leaving Miss Justinu with nowhere safe to sleep. And then the finding of the little corpse, the body of a child much younger than her, with his head cut off. She thinks maybe Dr. Caldwell cut his head off because that's the sort of thing that Dr. Caldwell does. Underneath the unhappiness, she finds a pure white anger. Dr. Caldwell has to be made to stop doing these things. Someone has to teach her a lesson. The wild children are just the same as she is, except they never got to have lessons with Miss Justinu. Nobody ever taught them how to think for themselves, or even how to be people, but they're learning without that help. They've already learned how to be a family, and then Dr. Caldwell comes and kills them as though they're just animals. Maybe they tried to kill her first, but they don't know any better, and Dr. Caldwell does. It fills Melanie with a rage so strong, it's almost like the hungry feeling. And discovering that she can feel like that makes her afraid. so she doesn't mind at all going out to explore the grey stuff. She thinks moving will be a lot better for her than staying still. Sergeant Parks and Miss Justineau find a loft in one of the houses of a three-storey Victorian terrace, a few streets away from where Rosie stopped. There's a ladder that leads up there, but once Sergeant Parks and Miss Justineau have climbed up, Melanie takes the bottom of it, while the two grown-ups take the top, and they manage between the three of them to rip it out of the metal brackets that hold it in place. Melanie catches it as it falls and lowers it carefully to the floor so that it doesn't make too much noise.
"I'll see you later,"
she calls up to them softly. She takes the walkie-talkie from her belt and waves it to show that she hasn't forgotten about it. She'll be able to talk to them, even if she goes far away. Miss Justineau whispers a reply, goodbye or good luck or something like that. Melanie is already running lightly back down the stairs, her bare feet silent on the rotten, moss-covered carpet. She picks a starting point at random and follows the edge of the grey mass. She starts off at a walk, but she's still filled with a sense of restlessness and urgency, so after a while she breaks into a trot and then into a run. She goes a long way, detouring wherever she has to, and then finding the wall again as soon as she can. It seems to go on forever. Its outer surface isn't totally straight. It goes in and out a lot, throwing out salients along the narrower streets, falling back a little where there are open spaces that offer less to cling to. But there's no sign of a break, and nowhere where Melanie can glimpse anything on the further side of the barrier. After she's been running for more than an hour, she stops. Not to rest, she could go on for a while yet without discomfort, but to check in with Miss Justineau and Sergeant Parks. She presses the stud on the walkie-talkie and says hello into it. For a long time it just crackles, but then Sergeant Parks' voice answers. How are you doing?
I went east, Melanie tells him. Quite a long way. The wall just goes on and on.
You've been walking all this time?
Running.
Where are you now? Can you see any street signs?
Melanie can't, but she walks on until she reaches another crossroads. North Church Road, she says. London Borough of Hackney.
She hears Parks breathing hard. And it goes on further than that?
A lot further, as far as I can see. And I can see a long way, even in the dark.
Melanie isn't boasting. It's just something Sergeant Parks needs to know. Okay. Thanks, kid. Come on back. If you feel like taking a look to the west, too, I'd be grateful. But don't wear yourself out. Come on back here if you're feeling tired.
I'm fine, Melanie says. Over and out.
She retraces her steps and goes the other way, but it's exactly the same. If they go around the wall, they'll have to go a very long way either to the east or to the west, and it's not clear where they'll be able to start going south again. Finally, Melanie finds herself standing directly in front of the wall, a few miles away from where they first met it. It's as thick here as it is anywhere, but the angle of its fall is different. An outcrop of grey froth leans forward a long way, right over her, and she can see the moon shining down through it. The stark, white glow is like a promise, an encouragement. If she pushes forward through the wall, she might be able to find the further side before she loses the light. Miss Justineau said it was dangerous, but Melanie doesn't see how, and she's not afraid of it. She takes a step forward, and then another. The grey threads are up to her ankles, then up to her knees, but they offer no resistance at all. They just tickle a little as she pushes through them, parting with the smallest sigh of not quite sound. The moon follows her, a moving spotlight in which everything opens itself up to her gaze. The grey threads quickly get thicker and thicker. Objects that she passes, rubbish bins, parked cars, post boxes, garden hedges and gates, are swathed in endless layers, turned into granite statues of themselves. 20 feet in, Melanie finds the first fallen bodies. She slows to a halt,
amazed at what she's seeing. The Hungries have fallen down in the middle of the street, or slumped at the basis of walls, just like the bodies they saw when they were walking into London. But there are so many more of them here. From their split skulls and exploded heads, grey stems about 6 inches in diameter have sprouted like the trunks of trees. The stems grow straight upwards to incredible heights, and the threads pour out from them at all angles in endless proliferation. Some of them connect to whatever other stems are nearest, making a dense net like a million spiderwebs all woven together. Others wrap around whatever is in their path, or if there's nothing, they shelve gently down to the ground. Wherever the threads touch the ground, another trunk appears, but these trunks are a lot thinner and shorter than the trunks that grow straight out of the bodies of the Hungries. Melanie goes closer. She can't help herself. The sad husks at the bottom of each fungus tree don't scare her. There's nothing of humanity left in them, nothing to remind anyone that they were once alive. They're more like clothes that someone has taken off and left lying on the ground. Close up, she can see the grey fruit that hangs on these ghost trees. She reaches up to touch one of the spherical growths, which is just a little higher up on the trunk than the top of her head. Its surface is cool and leathery, and gives very slightly under the touch of her fingers. She presses hard and makes an indentation. When she takes her hand away, the mark slowly disappears. The surface of the ball is elastic enough to spring back into shape. After a slow count of 10, it looks exactly the same as it did before she touched it. Melanie wanders on through the grey wilderness. It doesn't seem to have a further side, it just keeps going. And it keeps getting thicker. After a while, there's only just enough space between the trunks for her to slide her skinny body through, and the moonlight is dripping down like dirty water through a raft of threads so tightly intertwined they're almost like a solid mass. Melanie's shoulder bumps into one of the grey balls, and it falls to the ground with a muffled plop. She stoops to pick it up. There's a puckered ring where it was attached to the trunk, but the rest of the surface is smooth and unbroken. She squeezes it in her hand, and once again it returns quickly to the shape it had before she touched it. If she goes any further, she'll be bumping into the trunks. She touches one and finds that it feels unpleasantly clammy. She recoils a little. She was expecting the trunks to be smooth and dry like the fruit they bear, which in Melanie's opinion would have been a lot less disgusting. Something moves off to her left and she starts violently. She thought she had this twilit world to herself. A strange figure stumbles towards her, silhouetted in the dull moonlight. From the neck downwards it looks like a man, but it has no shoulders, or neck, or head. Its upper body is just an undifferentiated lump. She backs away from the thing, scared more than anything by its utter strangeness. But it's not attacking her. It doesn't even seem to know she's there. As it passes her, she recognizes it for what it is. It's a Hungry whose torso has started to split open. The first foot or so of one of the upright trunks is thrusting upwards from its chest, splintering spars of rib protruding outwards from its point of origin. Threads have blossomed profusely from the trunk, disguising what's left of the Hungry's head, which has been forced, whose torso has started to split open. The first foot or so of one of the upright trunks is thrusting upwards from its chest, splintering spars of rib protruding outwards from its point of origin. Threads have blossomed profusely from the trunk, disguising what's left of the Hungry's head, which has been forced sideways at a steep angle by the relentless upward growth. Melanie stares at the apparition, both relieved, because the horror of the unknown is more frightening than any horror you can understand, and revolted at this strange violation of human flesh. The Hungry stumbles on past her, its zigzag course dictated by the trunks it bumps into and bounces off. It's almost more ridiculous than it is horrible.
It will fall down soon, Melanie imagines, and then the trunk will be pointing sideways. It will have to find some